Devoncast
from Radio X.
Devoncast returns with the best bits from another packed week in the diaries of its local reporters. I'm Guy Henderson, and I'm joined this week by my local Democracy Reporting Service colleague Bradley Gerrard. Brad, you survived half term intact. You had a busy half term. You're in the midst of navigating a house move. I'm amazed you've managed to get as far as the studio. Busy times for you.
I'm amazed I'm here as well, Guy. Yes, yes. House moving is one of those stressful things that we're navigating it. As you say, it's in the process. The wheels are turning with conveyances and that sort of stuff. And half term was good. We went back to the big smoke and attended Harry Potter World on one day.
Really?
As well. Yeah.
Okay, good stuff. Enjoy it.
Yeah, I can take or leave Harry Potter. But the experience, if you ever get the chance to go to north of North Watford, wherever it is, it was impressive.
Excellent. But now you're back in the county, busy. It's a bit, a busy time, isn't it? Since the county council elections, it's all kind of skyrocketed a bit, hasn't it?
It has. It's gone fast. There's lots of things coming up. The new administration in County Hall, obviously, is getting its feet under the desk. There's lots of political jostling, I guess. You've got the fact that Reform is the biggest opposition party in County Hall. You've got, obviously, Julian Brazil, who's the leader of the Lib Dems and now the leader of the County Council, trying to set out his stall and trying to set out a sort of collegiate and friendly approach to the governance of the council. He's got Green member on his cabinet, which is interesting. So he needs the Greens really to get things through potentially. So it's County Hall alone is busy, never mind the other councils.
Good stuff. Well, in this Devoncast, we'll hear about the shortcomings in rural bus services. We'll visit a new nature trail in Totnes and we'll meet the man taking on one of the most glamorous roles in theatre. We'll also hear from Liberal Democrat MP Rachel Gilmore, who is spearheading a so-called countryside copper guarantee.
There will also be details of a veritable David versus Goliath planning battle in East Devon, where People Power won out. Plus, we'll talk to a local wine producer who made one expert declare, Burgundy, eat your heart out. But first,
well, parents fighting to save specialist units for deaf children at two Torquay schools have failed to get Torbay Council to change its mind. The council's closing the units at St Margaret's School and the Spires Academy and says children can be better served in their own mainstream schools. But the parents say vulnerable children will lose out. On Monday afternoon, a special overview and scrutiny meeting went into the issue in some detail. A 1,600-signature petition was handed in and a number of speakers aired all aspects of the complicated issue before the committee decided that closing the units would not harm services to the children who need them. Felicity Morris is secretary of the PTA at St Margaret's and has been leading the campaign to get the council to think again. After the meeting, I asked her what she thought of the decision to go ahead with the closures.
I think it's outrageous, to be honest. I think the council are not considering the future of the deaf children in Torbay or the hearing impaired children. They're hiding behind funding models that they've created themselves to meet their own funding requirements, but they've not considered the thoughts and feelings and actual lived experiences of the children and their families in the Bay.
Because one of the points you made, or points that was made in there, was that while financially there may be more money, you'll lose the community around that. Can you explain that a bit for me?
Yeah, so deaf children are twice as likely to have mental health issues. 40% of them report feelings of anxiety and isolation. And the great thing about what the unit at St Margaret's does is it creates a community and it helps those children to have a deaf identity. The children that are in other mainstream schools within the Bay, they may have a hearing advisory teacher come in every so often, as depending on what's in their EHCP, but they're not surrounded by other people in that situation. And obviously everybody's different with how they deal with their own kind of limitations or whatever it might be, but these children really, really benefit from having that community and identity.
And there have been reassurances during the meeting again from the councillors that when you go back in 6 months' time, the provision won't have changed. What do you think of that?
I think in 6 months' time, it may well not have changed because the funding will be there for all those children that are there at this point. But what will happen, in fact, 6 months may be an interesting marker to use, but in September 2026, you'll find that two of the EHCP-funded children will have left, which means that unless we have any further children coming up through the school, there won't be enough funding to have a qualified teacher of the deaf within, like, held, employed by the school. Therefore, there won't be one. And then if in a year's time, 2 years' time, we have more children coming through, we will have to then attempt to hire a teacher of the deaf, and they're in short supply. So it's the sustainability for the future, and that's something that the council weren't willing to discuss in that meeting.
So what happens next? Is there any further steps that you can take?
We will be looking at all options in terms of the legal implications of the decisions that they've made. Despite saying this only affects a small number of children, I think our stance on it may be slightly different, and we will be speaking to relevant parties to see what action we might be able to take.
That was campaigner Felicity Morris, talking there about Torbay Council's plans to close two specialist units for hearing impaired children in Torquay schools. An EHCP, which was mentioned there a couple of times, is an education, health and care plan which a child needs in order to trigger the support of the specialist unit.
Now, a Devon winery has made history on the international stage. Lime Bay Winery, based near Axminster, is the first English producer to win top awards for both red and white wine in the same year at the International Wine Challenge. Its 2020 Chardonnay and 2021 Pinot Noir were praised by judges for their depth, balance and elegance, with one judge saying, "Burgundy, eat your heart out." Radio X's Josh Tate caught up with Lime Bay's Stephen Sturgeon.
How does it feel to win two major international awards for both red and white wine in the same year?
It's brilliant. It really is wonderful for a number of reasons. One, obviously, because it really does show how good English wines are on the broader scale. But equally, it recognises the reputation that Lime Bay's had and been building out for the last 10 years for producing really good quality English wine.
What has the journey been like for Lime Bay Winery from making traditional drinks to now being recognised for award-winning wines?
It's been an unusual journey because, as you say, its heritage, its legacy was in sort of ciders and liqueurs and mead. And the owners set out to understand really how we could position ourselves to develop the English wine side of things, but also maintain the core business. So the English wine bit really came out of an idea that was had, and to work with English vineyards who produce really good quality grapes, and then bring those grapes to Devon, where we could press them and ferment them and bottle them into the wines that are on the shelf now. And I think that was an important decision, to work with the best vineyards in England versus having your own vineyard. And that was taken about 10 years ago. And the reason why that was important was kind of a couple of good reasons for that. One, it allowed us to work with a number of vineyards. And we talk about the best grapes from the best vineyards for the best wine. So that gave the winemakers at Lime Bay that flexibility to really start to work with the best Pinot Noir grapes, the best Chardonnay and the best Bacchus grapes. So that was part of the magic of it. And then I think the second part of it was more a focus on still wine. If you look at the marketplace for English wine at the moment, it is strongly biased towards sparkling wine. But making that decision to focus more on still meant that we've had, a good 8 years now of developing the quality and the reputation for the superb wines, which are exemplars as befits the trophy medals we've got. I think it's also worth pointing out, Josh, that although this year has been spectacular because of the uniqueness of the trophies, if you look at our reputation in still wine, we're probably one of the most awarded, based on the international awards, English still wines for a red and white. So you've got a legacy there of working with great vineyards. You've got a track record of year on year improving the reputation and the quality. And that's kind of really now culminated in these trophies. But the other part of Lion Bay, which is really exciting, is it's never, it hasn't lost that legacy for producing other brilliant products. And we're probably the biggest mead producer in the UK. We produce country fruit wine, and obviously we have a selection of liqueurs. So that really has meant over time, start to rationalize what we were doing, for example, move out of cider. That gave us the opportunity to focus part of the wine, to focus the winery on English wine and the meadery on producing top mead.
And would you say the warmer weather, which we've seen over the last few months, could that help with English wines over the next 10 years or so, if the weather stays as nice as it has been so far this year?
Absolutely. Just there's been a couple of factors, and this is well documented. One, most of the wine growers started very much in the Crouch Valley, which had, you know, superb weather for wine growing. But if you look at how, where wine vineyards that are sprouting out, they're sprouting out all over the south of England up to the Midlands, and that really is a significant reflection of climate change. So as colleagues in other parts of the world are suffering because it's getting too hot for grape, the climate is helping English and Welsh, don't forget, vineyards to thrive. And of course, it's not just the balance of the sun and the heat, it's the rain as well. And then if you look at where the really rich, ripe wine growing areas, it's the terroir, it's the ground. So those combinations of changing weather patterns, increasing temperatures, rainfall, and the soil is really helping the development. I think the second part of your question is important, and that is, you know, what's going to help grow English wine? And again, this is well documented, a mantle that has been picked up by Wine GB, and that is, we need the governments, whichever government, to help support our wine growing, because no two ways about it, it's going to grow. It's a burgeoning industry, and if we can get our wine to be more competitive in terms of its pricing, that can only lead to more jobs and obviously more income and taxes. And then the other component you said there about the growth of industry, we are seeing English wines being exported. Scandinavian countries in particular are thoroughly enjoying it. But, you know, we in Lion Bay are getting inquiries from Asia and other parts of Europe. So ultimately, the success of English wines and the growth of English wines, if we can compete with a level playing field with the rest of the world, can only be good for the economy as well.
That was Radio X's Josh Tate talking wine at Lion Bay with Steve Sturgeon. It is great to hear that English wine is on the rise, that's for sure.
Have you tried some English wine?
I have in the past. Wine. Yeah. Well, just think about the local ones near us. We've got sort of...
They're Sharpham, isn't
Sharpham, there? Sharpham, yeah. They just changed their name, which is why I was stumbling over it. But yeah, Sharpham Winery is obviously an amazing producer. And we've got more and more cropping up around the country. I know Pebble Bed in Exeter a while ago. I think they're still going, but...
It's good, though, isn't it? There are very many terrible things happening with the climate, but the fact that the climate is warming can have some benefits, certainly in the short term.
We can raise a glass while all our homes are flooding. Yeah.
yeah, that's true. Now, the second reading of a government bill on bus service reform in the House of Commons gave South Devon Liberal Democrat MP Caroline Vodon the chance to highlight some of the shortcomings in local services. She called for more resources for local authorities to deliver good bus services and said key workers in rural areas were among those hardest hit by the problems. But first, she talked about communities being simply left behind.
Buses are often seen as a service for the elderly, and they're vital for older residents, especially in rural areas where isolation poses a serious threat to health. Buses can be a social lifeline, but in these rural communities, they're also a vital connection to education, healthcare and work. Bus journeys in Devon have fallen by 40% since 2015, and in my large rural constituency of South Devon, many communities have been left behind by unreliable, infrequent or inadequate bus services. Many villages have no bus service at all. Others feel lucky to get one a day. One bus driver was left with no choice but to buy a car to get to work, as he would have lost his job if he couldn't get to Totnes by 7 a.m. Another constituent said, "These changes disproportionately affect key workers, particularly those in sectors such as healthcare, retail and hospitality, who depend on early or late bus services to commute. Many of these workers have few, if any, alternative transport options. These people are likely among the lowest paid in our community, and they will face increased financial and logistical challenges as a result of these cuts." When Stagecoach relocated the Dartmouth bus depot to Plymouth, the early morning 92 was cut, students couldn't get to college, and local drivers lost their jobs. Stagecoach also cut the 17 in Brixham, so no visitor, holidaymaker or hospitality worker can get home after 6:30 p.m. It's hardly a late night out. I welcome the principles behind this bill. It's right to give more powers to local authorities, and it's right to acknowledge that socially necessary routes must be protected. But this legislation has to go further if it is to truly deliver the bus revolution this government claims. Under this bill, local authorities must have the power and the funding to keep services running and a duty to implement socially necessary services. It's not just about commuting to work, though. Young people in South Devon depend on buses to get to college, but also to access that crucial first Saturday job, to build independence, to gain skills, and to put something real on their CVs. When you live in a small village with no shop, no cafe, and no reliable bus, how are you meant to get any experience if you can't travel? It's absolutely vital for the government's skills agenda. A well-funded, reliable rural bus network doesn't just support today's economy, it builds tomorrow's workforce. We've seen in Ireland what's possible. Rural bus use has increased fivefold since 2018 because the Irish government invested in rural transport and created new services where they were needed. That's the kind of ambition we need. Let's grow our economy by revolutionising rural transport with regular, clean, green buses. I wholeheartedly support giving real franchising powers to all local authorities with simple integrated funding and a focus on net zero buses. But let's not pretend that these powers alone are enough. Councils need the funding, the staff and the backing to use them. Raising the fare cap from £2 to £3 is also a false economy. For a student or someone on minimum wage, it's a real barrier to access. The cap must be restored and made permanent if we're serious about affordability and ridership and ironing out inequalities. I would also like to see authorities like Devon County Council have the power to introduce integrated transport passes like we use in London, so that people in rural areas can get the bus to get to a station and then take a train with a joined-up, cost-effective, user-friendly way. This bill has potential, but it must be backed with the ambition and investment rural communities like mine desperately need. Buses are for everyone, young or old, in cities, in villages, even on Dartmoor, and this House must deliver an ambitious, modern system that reflects that.
South Devon MP Caroline Vowden there, talking about bus services in rural areas of the county.
Really interesting topic, actually, because bus services, I learned this a few months ago, that the County Council does subsidise bus services to huge amounts. It's around sort of £12 or £13 million a year. But still, the actual service that's available in some areas is just so poor. It does really make life difficult for someone living in the rural community.
You're right. There's quite a lot of council money goes into bus services to try and plug the gaps and try and make sure that communities are served. But there's only so much money to go around. The government did announce some funding for public transport yesterday, but a lot of it has gone to other parts of the country. Somebody on TV was saying money's pouring into the West Country, it's going to Bristol. Bristol is not the West Country.
the very fringes, at least. Yes. I think we can agree that. But yes, you're right. Devon has not been included in that sort of bumper spending for transport. And I saw a comment from somebody saying that something particularly frustrating about that example is that you've got a scheme like Clumpton train station, for instance. Like, the station's there, there's a plan to reopen it. It was in the railway reopening scheme under the Conservatives before they lost the election, and you would think that Labour might therefore want to spend money on something that's pretty much ready to go, but I guess it must see merit in the other schemes.
Edge as well, Edgins Well, Holt at Torquay as well, planning permission granted, actually drove past the site this morning, could have done with a train there at Edgenswell this morning, but that's a long way off, a long, long way off.
Well, from one Liberal Democrat MP, Caroline Vaden there, to another. So the Liberal Democrat member for Tiverton and Minehead, Rachel Gilmore, is leading a campaign calling for more investment in rural policing. Ms Gilmore and fellow Lib Dem MPs across the South West are calling for a copper countryside guarantee, which would see dedicated rural crime teams of specialists embedded in every police force. According to data provided by the Lib Dems, just 0.4% of police staff are dedicated to rural crime, which Ms Gilmore said was nowhere near enough to tackle the rise of antisocial behaviour and other crime in rural communities. I spoke to Ms Gilmore about the initiative she's lobbying for and started by asking her where she thought the money for such a scheme could come from.
Well, we're asking it to come from government. We've written to the Home Secretary. The how much should be weighed by the amount that rural crime is costing my community in Tiverton and Minehead. And the NFU have estimated that the cost of rural crime in 2023 alone was worth £52.8 million, which is a lot of money. So investing a relatively small amount of money by comparison to that in a rural MP, a rural policing task force, just makes sense.
But in terms of the money, I know you're saying you want it to come from government, but the Home Office is reportedly going to be the one that's potentially most hit in the upcoming spending review. So normally with government, there's going to have to be some give and take, so taking money from somewhere to somewhere else. Or are you hoping that there could be extra money for this beyond what's already spent on policing?
Well, I had a meeting with Claire Moody, who's the Police and Crime Commissioner for Somerset and Avon, a couple of weeks ago, and she has got more resources for more police officers. So it might be that we all gang up, so to speak, and ask the Police and Crime Commissioners in Somerset and Avon and Devon and Cornwall to put more emphasis on the problems of rural and coastal crime. I was in Minehead on Bank Holiday Monday going to an event, and I nipped in to see one of my shopkeepers, and he said, you know, we've just had a group of youths come in and help themselves to whatever they want, and the police haven't been able to catch them, and, you know, they're in despair. I've had cattle rustled from Exford, sheep stolen from Bampton. I even heard some time ago now, I have to confess, a whole flock of chickens had been stolen from a farm outside Holcombe Rogus, which is also in my constituency. So it's quite blatant.
Might there not be an argument from the government, though, that it's up to police to apportion resources appropriately to the patch they monitor? So isn't the problem maybe with forces not putting their resources in the right place?
That's a message that the Home Office can send. You know, they can say to the Police and Crime Commissioners, we don't have any more money in the pot, but we've got the stats, we've got the figures from the NFU Mutual. This is becoming an increasingly difficult problem to solve. And we're looking to you to put your resources in a more strategic way so that people like my constituents can feel safe.
I did contact the Police and Crime Commissioner's office, and they said rural crime is one of Alison Hernandez's biggest priorities in the 2025 to 2029 crime plan, including a pledge to introduce measures to protect farmers and rural businesses from theft and ensure all rural thefts are investigated. So that makes it feel a bit like that what you're calling for is already being done anyway.
I have a constituency surgery every month at Cupcombe Market for my farmers. So I'm hearing I can't say on a daily basis, but certainly extremely regularly, that rural crime and coastal crime is on the increase. Now, you shouldn't be surprised by that. You know, people are living without as much money as they used to have. People are still facing austerity. People are becoming increasingly desperate to make money, unfortunately, not necessarily through legal means. So you can't just have a static figure or a static number of police officers. You've got to be able to reflect the priorities and the needs of rural and coastal communities.
Do you think rural crime is properly understood? By which I mean animals being stolen, people might not fully realise the consequences of that and the impact of it upon farmers.
My farmers are having an awful time of it, one way or another. And, you know, nobody should be able to shrug their shoulders and say, oh, somebody nicked, you know, three bullocks or heifers from a farm outside Exford. At the moment, beef prices are very high. So it is really serious. And as for a flock of hens, you know, 1,500 hens, and these were pedigree birds, and they laid expensive different coloured eggs. That's a serious amount of investment for that particular farmer.
So it does have real damaging financial and business impacts on the victims.
Yes, I think that's true. But I also think it's that sense of not feeling safe. You know, everybody has a right to feel safe where they live. And people shouldn't be looking over their shoulders worried about if somebody's going to burgle them or somebody's going to mug them or if somebody's going to walk into their shop and, you know, steal goods. That's the whole point of having a criminal justice system. Stealing is stealing. Burglary is burglary. Assault is assault. And I would be very reluctant to say, oh, this is worse than that, or this is bigger than that. Life for people in coastal and rural communities is very, very difficult. Anything that affects my constituencies in a negative way is something that I will campaign against. And rural crime and coastal crime fits into that category. And that's why I led the call for more investment from the police, particularly this idea of a copper countryside guarantee.
That was going to be my final question, the countryside copper guarantee. It's got a nice ring to it. It sounds like it might go down well with constituents. But what does it actually mean, and what would change in terms of the police force if there was such a guarantee?
It means that there would be a guaranteed number of police officers and support officers deployed into our coastal and rural communities. And the reason it's supposed to be quite punchy is because people will remember it.
So you would hope to have dedicated teams focused on the issues such as you describe, like animal and equipment theft, and solely focusing on rural and coastal areas?
A few, just before Christmas, I had a very distressing tale from a constituent outside Brompton Regis, and their sheep had been killed by a dog. And this is going to sound grandiose, I don't mean it to sound grandiose, but even though I'm the MP, I couldn't get through to a police officer who was looking into investigating it because they just simply weren't there. And I'm going to go back to what I said at the beginning. It is about the crime, but it's also about people feeling secure and safe where they live. And every citizen has a right to feel safe where they live, whether it's out on the middle of Exmoor or in the middle of Minehead or Tiverton. There should be no differential at all.
That was Rachel Gilmore MP talking to me there. Now, it's worth re-emphasising that the Police and Crime Commissioner's Office told us that rural crime was one of Alison Hernandez's key priorities for the 2025 to 2029 plan. That Police and Crime plan has pledged to introduce measures to protect farmers and rural businesses from theft and ensure all rural thefts are investigated. Furthermore, wildlife crime and illegal activities in remote areas are a major focus, with support for dedicated rural crime teams, tri-service safety officers and rural crime prevention groups.
This is interesting, isn't it? Because you think of rural crime and you think it's fairly low profile, but these are people's livelihoods, aren't they? People are stealing expensive machinery, people are stealing livestock. This is livelihoods at stake.
It is. I asked Rachel Gilmore that in the piece, as you heard there. I asked her about whether people truly kind of appreciate rural crime, because it can sound, as you say, if livestock's stolen, it can sound maybe to somebody who isn't familiar with farming and how it works that, oh, well, surely you can just buy some more. It can't be that problematic because they're just sheep or just cows. But actually, there's a lot of investment, a lot of hard work, a lot of care and attention that goes into livestock. And obviously, if someone just comes along and pinches even a fraction of your herd, that is obviously going to have a major financial, emotional toll on the farmer or farmers who've lost those animals. So it really is a serious crime, although it can sound maybe to people who aren't in rural communities it maybe isn't that problematic, that troublesome, just a bit inconvenient. But that view is potentially wrong, as Ms. Gilmore was saying, that, you know, these crimes are really serious. They have a real big impact on people, and farmers are working incredibly hard. And if someone just comes along and steals equipment or livestock, it really does have a huge, big impact.
It does. And as if farming communities didn't have enough to worry about at the moment as well. We'll keep on top of that story. Now we're turning to a major, long-running planning battle in East Devon that finally came to a conclusion. Brad, you've got more on this, so tell us what happened.
Absolutely, guys. So planning battles usually pitch local communities against the large developer or company. But the decades-long fight in East Devon to prevent a quarry opening has truly been a David versus Goliath contest. The Straight Gate Action Group was finally able to celebrate recently after Holcim, which is now the world's largest cement producer, opted to abandon its plans to create a quarry at Straight Gate Farm near Ottery St Mary. The scheme has been fought by the current cohort of campaigners for about 25 years, but has a history going back to 1967 when the first application was submitted by English China Clays, which was a predecessor of Aggregate Industries that is now Holcim. I spoke to campaigner Rupert Thistlethwaite and started by asking him what his reaction was when he heard that Holcim had finally decided to stop pursuing its plans for the site, acknowledging it would let its planning permission lapse.
Elated. But we did have an inkling, actually, and have had for the last couple of months.
And what gave you that inkling?
Because they weren't checking our water anymore. And that was one of the conditions they needed to satisfy in order to proceed. So why weren't they doing it?
And that was that related to water? That was one of yours and your campaign group's key concerns, was it?
Well, it was certainly my key concern, because I run a historic house called Cadhay, and I'm sure Cadhay is located where it is because it has a plentiful supply of water, and that's both our drinking water and it feeds the medieval fish ponds.
And presumably Holcim, who were the applicant, were suggesting they could create this quarry and not cause any problems to that water source, but I'm guessing your view was quite the opposite.
Well, no one disputed that where they were digging the quarry was the catchment area for our water, because our water actually comes out of a spring, but obviously the catchment area is slightly further away. So no one was disputing that. The only thing was dispute, what would the effect of building a quarry in it? And common sense tells me that it's going to muck it all up. And our hydrologist confirmed that. Of course, they managed to find hydrologists who thought, oh, no, it's absolutely fine.
I guess this is the case with experts, isn't it? You always find one to back up a view. But
yeah, but they, you know, when you then said to them, okay, well, then you'll guarantee our supply in case it fails, and then they back off. So you can tell they weren't entirely sure of their ground.
And can you explain to me, because this campaign has been going on for years, if not decades even, really. When did your involvement start? And can you sort of just explain what kind of effort and toll this has taken on you and the fellow campaigners?
Well, more on fellow campaigners. I mean, it has been going on for years and years. My uncle fought it, I think, starting about 60 years ago. But I inherited the house 25 years ago, and almost immediately we're into this campaign. My role has been sort of helping in the background and financing some of it. And because, you know, I stood to lose so much. But I can't really claim that I did all the legwork, because there was something called the Straightgate Action Group, which is absolutely fantastic. They were, you know, brilliant from beginning to end, and slowly they managed to just chisel away, so that, and each time it became more difficult for the applicant to make a successful quarry there.
What struck me about this case as well, as often, as I sort of said in my intro to the piece on this for our podcast, is that planning application battles often between a community and a big sort of developer. But often what happens is that the people win out at the decision stage, or the scheme that they don't like is blocked. But actually, in this case, the planning inspector gave this scheme permission, yet Straightgate Action Group still kept going and kept pushing to try and prevent it.
Yes, I mean, the decision was hedged about, and they had a lot of conditions and hurdles to jump. And in the end, I suspect they were too big for them to get over.
And so
it was sort of slightly unexpected that they won, frankly, but it was a sort of hollow victory in that, as I say, they had quite a lot of conditions to meet, some of which were quite tricky.
Yeah, it was like more than 50 conditions or something, I think, wasn't it, from memory, looking at the planning inspector's decision?
Yeah, so it wasn't a complete victory for them. And, you know, as it turns out, it was too difficult for them to do.
And so finally then, what does the community do now? I'm presuming it's a big sigh of relief. Is it hoping for anything more from Holcim, the company? Does it want an apology, or do you want some sort of financial gift or donation towards something, given all your effort? Or are you just pleased to see the back of this?
I'm just delighted to see the back of it, frankly. It's going to make so much difference to Cadhay. And I think it'll make quite a lot of difference to the community, because it would have been quite a lot of upheaval.
That was campaigner Rupert Thistlethwaite speaking to me there.
Always interesting when a local community takes up arms and takes up placards and takes on a massive company with massive resources.
It really is. And looking at the Straightgate Action Group website, it was pretty phenomenal, I have to admit. It was very, very in-depth. Every document you could ever possibly perceive that might have existed in relation to this scheme was there. These campaigners were thoroughly organised. They were thoroughly passionate, thoroughly dogged. And after such a long time, they must be relieved. It's I did hear a comment from somebody that actually on their website there was a suggestion that they were maybe hoping that Hulkin might give an apology or give a donation of money because of the sort of tumultuous situation that they've created in the community. And there was another example they gave where a big company did give a donation of, I think, of tens of thousands of pounds or something. Better than nothing. Not enough in that community's mind, but
Holcim UK, which is the firm behind the proposed Straightgate quarry that will now no longer go ahead, did send us a statement about its decision to step away from the site. It said that it had agreed to sell Straightgate Farm and it no longer seeks to quarry the land. It said that planning permission to quarry the Straightgate Farm site was granted on appeal in January 2023 to extract more than 1 million tonnes of sand and gravel reserves from the area. It acknowledged the history of the site went back to 1965 when a planning application by English China Clays was submitted. But it said following a change in business strategy and direction, which has included a review of the planned site, the company has decided not to proceed with quarrying at Straightgate. It said it had informed Devon County Council of this and that it intended to allow the planning permission to lapse. It said it recognised the local community would welcome the clarity and certainty the decision would bring.
The community there in Ossington area would just be relieved that they can finally let this one go and they will know that a quarry at Straightgate Farm, which in documentation on the Action Group's website, has been in existence. There's reference to it going back to the 1600s, this farm. So it's a very historical, very biologically important, ecologically important site. And so I think, yeah, the campaigners, either they do not get a sorry and do not get a donation towards something, I think they would just be relieved that they can just not have to put so much attention towards fighting this scheme.
And there are similar battles going on elsewhere in the county, aren't there? I think there's one in Newton Abbott at the moment as well. And campaigners in places like that will take some comfort, I suppose, from what's happened with the Straightgate Action Group, that it can be done with the organisation, the dogged determination, it can be done.
Exactly. I think what was fascinating about this one was that the planning permission was originally rejected, then the company went to appeal. The planning inspector gave the company permission for it, but still the campaigners didn't stop. I think that was the key thing. They kept going. They kept highlighting the problems with the scheme. You had Jess Bailey, the councillor for the area, actually after the planning inspector gave permission, she lodged an effort to get some trees on the site protected because they were mature trees. She was genuinely worried about them. But the frustration basically to stop the campaign, it kept happening. They kept pursuing avenues to try and convince the company that the scheme really was a bad scheme in a bad place, even though they were given permission for it.
So, as they used to say on a well-known TV program, and now for something completely different, Richard O'Brien's legendary rock and roll musical Rocky Horror is back on the road, packed with timeless classics like The Time Warp and Sweet Transvestite. It comes to the Princess Theatre in Torquay in a matter of weeks. Jamie Taylor caught up with Adam Strong, who's playing the iconic role of Dr. Frankenfurter, to see how it's going.
It's been the most amazing experience so far. And, I mean, who doesn't want to play Frankenfurter? What a role. The songs, the iconic costumes, lines. Just, I'm having the best time.
And what sort of, how long does it take you to get into the world, into the character? Because you can't just go straight on stage. Surely there's a lot that needs to be done, isn't there?
I tend to do half of my makeup before we do warm up. So I'll normally get into the building about half an hour before we go and do physical warm up and vocal warm up. All in all, it takes me about an hour and a half to get ready. But one thing I can't get used to is because of the nature of the other characters in the show, I am not ready when the show starts. So I don't have a wig on, I don't have a costume on. It takes a while to get used to because they're getting everybody else ready and because I'm not in the first 20 minutes of the show, but I like to be ready.
But I mean, what an entrance you have. The song, everything about it, it's bang. Adam's here, or Dr. Frank is here, more like.
Oh, it's like nothing I've ever known. Like I'll never forget my first show. I opened in Bournemouth in February and it's very, very dark behind those doors at first. Frank has his own speakers either side of him. But you can just feel the drums above you on the platform and the whole place in around you is pounding with sound. And then, of course, the doors open, the smoke goes, and then you start one of the most iconic songs, if not the most iconic song on the show.
I know. It's one of those, isn't it? Everyone goes away remembering that one. And of course, Tim Curry did such a good job in the film. In terms of prepping for the role, did you take inspiration from the film or did you think, oh, I'm gonna come up with my own?
I think it was a bit of both. So I'm a massive fan of the film, but I'm also a huge fan of the stage show. And David Bedella will always be my Frank. So I think I took a lot of inspiration from his portrayal of Frank. When I first saw it, must be 20 years ago now, I knew that I wanted to play Frank in this version of the show. But yeah, of course, who doesn't love Tim Curry's portrayal as well? I think the good thing is Christopher Luscombe, who's our director, he allows us to create our own Franks. So each Frank you go and see, whether it's me or Jason or whoever is playing it at the time, you know, you see a unique interpretation of the actor's portrayal of the role.
Have you got a favourite moment in the show?
I mean, obviously Sweet Transvestite is a no-brainer, but I think one of my favourite moments is singing I'm Going Home. It's the only real moment for Frank where he's not being a narcissist or not being, you know, the controller of everything around him, and he shows real emotion, and I think it's just such a beautiful song. It's just an honour to get to perform it.
Last time when I saw it, I think I saw it in Plymouth quite a while ago, one of the audience members called Dr. Frank deliciously grotesque, which I think is spot on, would you not say?
Oh, 100%. I think I've had something similar to that in some of the reviews. It's a great way to describe him.
Yeah.
And he is. He manipulates everyone around him, but just as fabulous with it at the same time.
That must be a bit of a balance to get used to at the start.
Oh, 100%. I think, where does the crazy scientist end? Do you know what I mean? It's a bit of a bit of an odd one. The most difficult thing to get used to is the audience shouting out.
Yes, there's a lot of that, isn't there?
There's a lot. And of course, as a Rocky Horror fan, I knew most of the shout outs, so I was expecting them. But even now, I mean, we can't say it on the radio, some of them, but most of them, actually. There's some that even shock me now. And especially on a Saturday night when, you know, all of the hardened fans are in. And I know, because I've done about 100 shows of it now, I can tell the voices of the fans as to what kind of show we're going to have before I've even entered.
And you're not meant to, but there's parts of the show where audiences throw things on stage, isn't there?
I mean, yes, and I don't deal with that very well. Somebody threw a pack of cards at me during I'm Going Home. But I didn't see it at first until I turned round and I could see Jamie Leigh, who plays Columbia. She was trying to, like, get them away from me because obviously I'm in a 5-inch heel. They're slippy. But yes, I don't enjoy that. They normally get... They're not allowed the water pistols and stuff anymore, as they used to back in the day.
And the bread. I remember when I went in, there was a sign and it said, please don't bring in any bread. I was like, why would I bring bread to a theatre?
I mean, we still get the newspapers, but not so much. Obviously, the water pistols are banned. The cards happen a lot, but normally they throw them in the audience. But this particular day, they threw them at me.
What's the weirdest thing you've had thrown at you?
Underwear.
Oh, in this show?
Oh, in this show? No, I've only had the cards thrown at me. The security are quite good on this. Oh, no, that's a lie. We get a lot of Columbia hats thrown to the stage at the end.
There really is no show like it, and it's been going now for 50-plus years. What is it about Rocky Horror that keeps people coming back?
I think people just fall in love with it. My family didn't really understand it until they came to watch it a couple of times, and even, like, my dad, of all people, who I was not expecting, he's obsessed with it. He goes around the house singing the songs. I think it's a lot of fun. It's still relevant. The story is still relevant today, as crazy as it may be. The songs, the costumes, where... Do you go to the theatre where you can dress up and go as your favourite character and not be judged? You know, there's no judgment at Rocky Horror. It's fascinating for us as actors to look out there and watch them all having a great time just in all their favourite costumes for their favourite character. And it's got such a lovely fan base. They're really, really nice. They follow us more or less to every venue.
I'm sure they'll be following Rocky Horror when it arrives at Princess Theatre in Torquay from Monday the 16th to Saturday the 21st of June. Brad, I've got a terrible confession to make. I have never seen Rocky Horror.
You're missing out, Guy. I have done. And just before the recording of this podcast, I was telling you about a time when I did go and see it with my mum and stepdad. They bought tickets. They also took along my nan, who was not very impressed, let's say. So maybe if you are going to go, maybe consider who you're taking along with you, but and their sensibilities, I mean. But it is, the production I saw at the Theatre Royal some years ago now was fantastic, and I'm sure this one will be as well. The script, the story, it is just brilliant.
So we're saying it's a little bit racy. It's what my grandmother used to say was a bit warm, perhaps.
That's a nice way of putting it.
Great, great fun, and it sounds as if it's going to be very, very well produced.
It's great fun. It's hilarious. It's a real sort of real show. But yes, if your grandparent has certain old-fashioned sensibilities, maybe leave her or your grandfather at home and just tell them a sort of condensed version when you get back.
Just go and have a good time. So back to nature. Precious salt marshes alongside the River Dart at Totnes have become a lot more accessible thanks to a new boardwalk. Salt marshes like the one at Longmarsh are vital habitats for young fish, birds and insects, and signs along the new path will help users to understand more about them. The project has been funded by the Environment Agency and South Hams Council, which owns the land, and the project has come together thanks to 13 separate partners, including the Bioregional Learning Centre. Here's Tracy Eberle from the centre.
We're very, very delighted to finally be here and be able to open the replacement boardwalk at Longmarsh. So we're truly blessed that, as I say, this has been a really collaborative, all-encompassing project. And it's the end of the 3 years, and we're 13 different partners have been involved along that journey.
Steve Marks from the Environment Agency explains why a salt marsh like the one at Totnes matters so much.
Salt marshes lock up more carbon than forests. For the environment, they are so critical for reducing our greenhouse gases, but they also provide such an important biodiversity hotspot and provide a habitat for such a diverse range of plants and animal species. Salt marshes play an absolutely key role. We've restored 4 hectares of salt marsh, so we are reversing that trend in our salt marshes. So how has it been done here? Well, it's been done with real innovation, and that's a real key thing. But here I've learned how restoring the habitat has used both local and international knowledge on salt marsh restoration. I think that's quite unique in this example of that blending of local knowledge with modern technology. The boardwalk that we can see is really key because it increases the access to nature, and I think providing access to nature to all people, as diverse a range as possible, is really important. So it's great to see that these habitats can then be enjoyed by many.
For South Hams councillor John McKay, whose ward on the west bank of the Dart is the Totnes, Ashbrington, Cornworthy side, the project shows what can be done when people come together.
What an amazing project. We've just completed the South Brent Woodland, and that, just like this, it's been a collaboration of lots and lots of agencies, the Environment Agency, the Woodland Trust, and all sorts of people. And this is another example of agencies working together and to produce something that is quite extraordinary. I mean, I've just been privileged to a trip up the river and seen the salt marshes up and down the banks, and I learned a lot about how these things function. And it's extraordinary the work that's gone on to preserve these habitats. And this particular one here is just a very small part of it. And the boardwalk that is providing sort of public access is so important that people can actually see. And if I stop talking for a second, you can hear the birds. It is an extraordinarily peaceful spot, and to make that accessible to people, I think, is really, really important part of the project.
And for the Mayor of Totnes, Emily Price, it's another great asset for a very popular town.
As a community, the people of Totnes who walk this route, to be able to do the circular walk and access this beautiful piece of terrain is just going to be invaluable. I'm really delighted. I'm assured that the Harbour Authority actually do offer boat trips regularly, 12 times a year or so, and they are public access, and I really recommend it because the work that's gone on all the way down the river is fantastic. So this is just a small, really evident part of it. There's all work down the river, which is really worth going to have a look at as well.
The Totnes Longmarsh Boardwalk Project, complete with a lot of very vocal magpies in the background. I'm definitely going to go and take a look at that.
That's Devoncast, your weekly podcast rounding up all the county's crucial stories. A little shorter than usual this week because we both have council meetings to be at and the ever-turning wheels of local democracy stop for nobody. Thank you for listening, wherever you're listening, and whatever you're doing while you listen. Don't forget to subscribe, and remember, you can find us on Devoncast Radio on DAB across most of the county. We'll be back next week.
Catch the latest episode of Devoncast every Friday at radiox.co.uk or wherever you get your podcasts.